is a character that elicits two kinds of reactions. You either admire him in some cases, or you despise him in others. We despise him because he stole his brother's inheritance by deception. That was a despicable act. When he flees from his brother and lives with his uncle Laban, and Laban tricks him out of some inheritance or some stuff, we go, "Yes, Laban, Jacob got what he deserves." And then when Jacob goes back to see his brother Esau after many years, he's still scared of Esau's reaction. So what he does is say, men and women first, animals next. They will go across the river, and I will stay on this side. And if Esau gets nasty, then I've got a ready escape, because he's going to kill all the women and children first. Then he's going to take the animals. Then he's got to cross the river before he can get to me. What a man of integrity. What a man that says women and children first. So he's a man that elicits different kind of responses. As for his good response, we're going to read three of them today. Not necessarily speak about the first one, about the last two. Jacob was a man who met God and recognized it. Jacob was a man who specialized in what we would call today process system engineering, and he used it. Jacob was a man who had immense strength, and he used it. So let's read the passage together. We're going to read in Genesis. We're going to start at one earlier than we usually have been asked to do. We're going to look at Genesis 29. And we'll read at verse 10. Jacob left Beersheba and set out for Haran. So that's the part of the story, the introduction to it. That's verse 10. Let's go down to verse 18. Early the next morning, Jacob took a stone he had placed under his head and set it up as a pillar and poured oil on top of it. He called that place Bethel. Now, I don't know about you, and you can just read through that text and say he pushed a stone up. But if you're going to push up a marker that's going to be there for centuries so that people can see what happened there, you're going to choose a pretty big stone. And I would suggest to you that the stone Jacob picked was a huge stone. But Jacob had the strength to move it from the horizontal position to the vertical position. Later on in one of the stories we're going to read on, Jacob moves a stone that took at least three people, normal people, to move it. So let's go on now into the next chapter, into 29. Then Jacob continued his journey, that's from Bathsheba to Haran, and came to the land of the eastern people. There he saw a well in the open country with three flocks of sheep lying near it, because the flocks were watered from that well. The stone over the mouth of the well was large. When all the flocks were gathered together, the shepherds, notice the plural, the shepherds would roll the stone away from the well's mouth and water the sheep. Then they would return the stone to its place over the mouth of the well. Jacob asks the shepherds, "My brothers, where are you from?" "We're from Haran," they replied. He said to them, "Do you know Laban, Nahor's grandson?" "Yes, we know him," they answered. Then Jacob asked them, "Is he well?" "Yes, he is," they said. "And here comes his daughter Rachel with the sheep." "Look," he said, "the sun is still high. It is night time for the flocks to be gathered. Water the sheep and take them back to pasture." "We can't," they reply, "until all the flocks are gathered and the stone has been rolled away from the mouth of the well. Then we will water the sheep." While he was still talking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she was a shepherd. When Jacob saw Rachel, daughter of Laban, and Laban's sheep, he went over and rolled the stone away from the mouth of the well and watered his uncle's sheep. Now, what do guys do when they meet a pretty girl for the first time? They want to impress her. So what does Jacob do when he sees this pretty girl? He wants to so impress her, he rolls a stone away from the well that normally would take three men to do. I wonder if she was impressed. Then Then Jacob kissed Rachel and began to weep aloud. He told Rachel that he was a relative of her father and a son of Rebekah. So she ran and told her father. As soon as Laban heard the news about Jacob, his sister's son, he hurried to meet him. He embraced him and kissed him and brought him to his home. And there Jacob told him these things. Then Laban said to him, "You are my flesh and blood." So there are three stories we need to look at. The first is the story of the problem of the well. The second is a love story. Guy meets girl. Guy flips, does something silly to impress his girl. The third one is the importance of family and the usefulness of family in circumstances that may be difficult. So let's deal with the first one. The problem is quite difficult to understand. But here is what happened. There was one well, but there were many flocks of sheep. So what would happen is that all these flocks would come together at the well. There was at least three when Jacob met them, and with the coming of Rachel, that would have been four. And it wasn't until all the flocks had gathered together that they rolled the stone away from the well and started to feed the animal. Now Jacob comes along and he says, this is a huge process problem. Remember, they didn't have cell phones that they could phone, hey, I'm 10 minutes away from the well, see you there. They couldn't text, they couldn't call. The only way that they could sort of come up with being there at the same time was they could look at the sky and say, the sun is right overhead, time to go to the well. So all these flocks, at least three, well, four, would gather together in the one place, and then they would be watered. Now that is a problem. The first problem is that you have sheep sitting around or lying around, not eating, because they would have eaten all the grass around the well. They would have nibbled it right down to the ground. So there was nothing for them to eat. And so they were sitting there or lying there, not being fed, not receiving nutrition, not getting the stuff to help them grow. The second logistic problem is when everyone came together, whether it be four plus or more, there was a huge demand on the resources of the well. It meant that the shepherds had to go down into the well or get the water from the well up into the land or into the troughs for at least four groups of sheep. Now that's a huge logistical problem. Huge. That's a lot of water that needs to be brought up out of the well. So Jacob looks and says, you know, we have a problem here, guys. Well, why don't you do it this way? Why don't you water your sheep as soon as you get to the well? Then it will be a smaller problem because you'll only have one herd to feed. It will mean that your sheep will be watered. They can go to a pasture and eat. They will be better quality sheep. You're going to get more money for them in the market. And thirdly, you're going to have time for them to go eat before they go to sleep, before they're put into their fold. So from a logistic viewpoint, Jacob's solution to the problem is also easy, is provides some benefits in that the sheep are going to be better fed. The shepherds are going to get more money for them. It's an easier process in the terms that you only have to feed one group of sheep at a time. From every viewpoint, it is a logical solution to the problem. That's why I call him a process engineer. So what do the shepherds say? Nope, can't do it. We've been doing it this way for hundreds of years, and we can't change. And they lose out on a tremendous opportunity of a suggestion to change things around and improve the quality of their sheep. So that's the problem. Now, as I looked at that story, I'm beginning to think that God used Jacob's talent in process engineering to come up with a solution to a problem. God used Jacob's strength to move the stone away so that they could get at the water. Now, you may argue that Joseph wanted to impress Rachel, so he just did this. Be that as it may, that's what happened. And as I looked at that story, God uses a person's natural intellectual abilities, a person's natural health abilities, like being strong, for his praise and glory. And then I started to look and say, does God use our natural abilities for his praise and glory? And I found a lot of interesting things. God calls people in the middle of their secular employment. Matthew was a person who sat at a desk. He was a white-collar worker. He looked after taxes. And Jesus comes to him and says, follow me. And Matthew gets up and follows Jesus. Jesus comes to a group of blue-collar workers as they're standing repairing their nets. And he says, follow me. And Jesus calls these two to follow him in the middle of what we would call secular employment. And I'd like to suggest that God calls us in the middle of our secular employment to follow him. To follow him in the way that we work, I don't think it means we get up and quit the job right there and then. What I think it means is for us is that it means we should do God's work when we work. We should show that we belong to Christ and that we do his work, but that we also do our regular work well. That we believe by doing our regular work, we serve God. And when we do our regular work well, God is glorified. So the first thing about secular work is that God calls us in the middle of our secular work and says, follow me. The second thing I noticed is that in a lot of the Bible, there are writers or additions to the text. People are described as to what they do. For example, there's a lady called Lydia. And Lydia lived in the city of Philippi. And she's described as being a seller of purple. Could have been a seller of purple cloth or a seller of purple dye. And again, we would read over that if we didn't realize that we're dealing with first century Rome. Women were kept at home. They didn't go out shopping every day. They stayed in the house. But here was a lady who ran a business. She was a seller of purple. And beside that, it was a high-end type such sale. It wasn't a low-end stuff that she was selling. The stuff that she was selling, purple, was a very expensive dye and a very expensive cloth. And the Bible comments, this is Lydia, a seller of purple. And right away, it gives us a different picture of Lydia. There's a man called Cornelius. And Cornelius is described as a centurion, which means he was an officer in the Roman army. But we're given additional information about Cornelius. He was a centurion, and he came from the Italian regiment. Now, we've lost in history what the Italian regiment was. But my suspicion is that it was an elite group, an elite division of the Roman army. And here was a man who was an officer in a regiment, an elite regiment in the Roman army. That, to me, says an awful lot about where God calls people. Thirdly, there's a man called Simon. Now, Simon is described as a tanner. That is, he works with leather. He takes the hide and makes it such that it can be sellable and usable. We're told a little bit more about Simon. He lives by the seaside. And if you go to Joppa today, you can go to Simon's house. It's right by the seaside, right on the seafront. Got a nice location. But as I look at these people, all of them are described by their occupation. And that's nothing unusual in the New Testament. Now, let's bring that into today. Very often we think of ourselves as cogs in a machine. We're blobs. God is not interested in what we do Monday to Friday, 9 through 5. He really doesn't worry whether we work at a desk, whether we're a blue-collar worker, whatever we do. I would like to suggest that by putting these jobs at the end of the description, God is saying work is important. Work is useful. I am interested in what you do 9 to 5. Now that gives us a different appreciation of work. When we work, At our job, not only do we work for our employer, but we work for God. That comes across in Paul's letter to the Colossians. Now, if we get that into our thinking, it raises us to a whole different level of going to work each morning. Now, the second thing that we notice that is descriptive is that in the New Testament, we find descriptions of health. One man is described as Simon the leper. He had a health problem, and his health problem was his leprosy. And I suggest to you that that title would indicate that God is interested in our well-being. So if God is interested in things like that, interested in where we work, interested in our health, then I would suggest to you that he loves us, that he cares for us, that he wants to know us on a better relationship than just being a blob. When my kids were younger, we used to watch Star Trek. And in Star Trek, there were a group of people, I don't know what you would call them, called the Borg. And the Borg were totally automated people. They did everything the same. They plugged themselves into a charger and charged themselves up. They did it all in one motion. They fought exactly the same way. They did everything the same way. God doesn't regard us as Borgs. God regards us as individual people with individual talents, with individual gifts and abilities. And he would like us to use those talents and abilities for his praise and glory. Now let's move on. Part of the trouble of reading the New Testament, in particular in English, is that it all reads the same. People tell me that there's a vast difference in the Greek. And as I started to read through the Gospels and the Acts of the Apostles, there's a huge difference in the way people write. For example, Matthew is a tax collector. He's interested in money. So when Jesus tells a parable, and I'll use an example of when Jesus mentions, this one man was given a dollar, another was given $5, another was given $10. When it comes to Matthew's gospel, it's totally different kind of thinking. One man is given $1,000, another man is given $5,000, another man is given $10,000. And Matthew's interest in money is reflected in the examples that he chooses and the way he describes the parable. His interest is reflected in his writing. Second one is Mark. Now, Mark is universally agreed upon as being written by Peter, or dictated by Peter, and Mark wrote it down. Peter describes himself as an eyewitness. And as you read through Mark's gospel, it could only be described by an eyewitness. For example, when there's a feeding of the 5,000, it's Mark alone tells us that they sat down on green grass. Now you could read over that until you go to Israel. And green grass is not something in huge commodity. The very fact that Peter mentions it, or Mark mentions it, is that Peter has looked and said with his attention to detail, the grass was green where we sat. There's also another incident. There was a storm, and Mark describes that Jesus was asleep in the bottom of a boat on a cushion. No other gospel writer tells us that Jesus was in the bottom of the boat and he was on a cushion. It's only Mark, with Peter dictating to him, with Peter's attention to detail, that we find all kinds of things out. Now, when we come to Luke, things are different. Luke is a doctor. In fact, he's a real nice doctor. He's called Luke the beloved or loved physician. He was a person that everyone liked or could like quite easily. And he's a doctor. So when he writes from really a medical perspective. He tells how long this person has had the disease. He tells in a little more detail what the disease is compared with other writing. There is one incident where a lady comes and she's been bleeding for many years, and she touches the hem of Jesus' garment and she is healed. If you read Peter's version of the story, it reads like this. She had spent all her money on physicians, and rather than getting better, she got worse. Now, Luke, being a doctor, doesn't put it quite as bluntly as that. He puts it, she spent all her money on trying to get better. Luke is a doctor. Where do we find the stories about the virgin birth? Luke's gospel. Luke, as a physician, would inevitably have been interested. Really? A virgin birth? It's unknown. And in the first part of the text, he writes in Luke that he carefully examined all the stories. So one of the messages is that God uses our individual characteristics to bring about his glory and tell his story. Now, it's the same story. There is one God, one faith, one gospel, one spirit. But we can tell it in different ways. When Frank preaches, it's not the way I preach. When George Adema preaches, it's not the same way that Frank or I preach. We're different. And God uses our different ways and talents and abilities to bring about his word. So you do things at work a little different than the way I would do it. So be it. You tell people about Jesus Christ in a different way than you use different words than I would. But the message is the same, even though the way we tell it is quite different. And when God started to inspire the New Testament, he didn't sit down and say, hey, Luke, I want you to take dictation. And here's what I want you to say. And Luke dictated the words right out of the mouth of God, that it was a dictation. It's not like that. The Gospels vary too much in the way they word things. And I think God meant and inspired every word so that it is true. But he used different abilities of people in order to bring it about. Now, if we look at 1 Peter and 2 Peter, there's a huge difference. If we read 1 Peter, and again, I can't read Greek, but my friend who is a PhD in 1 Peter told me that Peter is a beautifully written letter. Beautifully written. It's almost like it's been written by a professional. And we know that it was written by a man called Silas. And we think Silas had the job of being an amanuensis. That's a harsh word for saying he was a secretary. He took dictation. And when Peter dictated his letter, Silas wrote it down, and he wrote it down in beautiful Greek. When 2 Peter comes along, the Greek apparently is abysmal. It's appalling. It's like first-grade English writing. Why? Well, Silas is not around. Peter is writing. Peter was not trained in Greek school. Peter was not trained in writing Greek. And so as he writes his second letter, it's totally different. And again, I would suggest to you that God uses our individual talents and abilities and the way we do things for his praise and glory. Now, let's move on. The last thing I want to talk about is God uses us in our employment for his praise and glory. Jesus is preaching by the lakeside, and people are gathering around, and Jesus is forced back and back and back. Until in the end, he's right at the edge of the lake. So he tells the fishermen, bring one of your boats over. He gets into the boat, moves out a little bit from the land, and starts to preach. Again, he uses the things that his followers had for God's praise and glory. If we look at Paul had a trade. He was either a leather worker or a tent maker. The word is not quite clear. So wherever Paul went, he used his trade as a tent maker or leather worker in order to have a job so that he could stay in that town or city, earn money, live there, and preach the gospel. In fact, he almost complains in one place that he's the only apostle that actually works for a living. God uses your workplace, the place where you work or can do, for his praise and glory. So what is the conclusion of what I'm trying to say? Is that your secular employment, where you work, how you work, what you do at work, is of interest to God. God isn't just interested in what you do in religious activities. God is interested in what you do in what we call secular act. And once we realize that, I think it will raise the level of our work. It will raise the level of how we approach work, what we do at work, how we react at work. Remember, where we work honors God. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for your word. And I have to admit, it's kind of an unusual topic, but thank you for giving me the way of thinking about it. And Lord, as we go to work on Tuesday, probably Monday is a holiday, we ask that we may remember that we're not just working for the person who pays us, but we are working for you. And may we that reflect in the way that we work. May it reflect in the way we deal with our fellow employees and with our bosses. Lord, we pray that the way we work will honor and glorify you. We commit ourselves to you and to your care. Amen.